So Revelation 21 is the end of the book of Revelation. We just have Revelation 21 and 22 to go over. And what has happened is it's the end of human history. So Jesus came back. He ruled and reigned for 1,000 years. There was a rebellion that Satan led. Jesus put it down. He judged everyone who was wicked, and he put them all in the place that they're supposed to be in, which is the lake of fire. And so the only people left are the righteous, are those who follow Jesus, those who love Jesus, those who want to be with Jesus. And this is what we as Christians call our heavenly hope. This is what we're all going for. Before we get into this really quickly, we're going to be talking about a lot of things about what heaven's going to look like at this point. Just so you guys know, if we die today, what happens is it says in 2 Corinthians 5, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. What happens is if you died today, you would go into the presence of God, but you wouldn't be on this particular part of heaven. Because this heaven is created after all those things I said is going to happen, if that makes sense to you guys. But we need to remember why John is writing this. Sometimes when we're getting into Revelation, we forget the fact that this was a book written to a specific group of people. Yes, Seth. Yes. It's not purgatory. Purgatory is what people believe is a punishment, actually. So purgatory is you would go to a place where you would suffer for your sins for a while, and then after you suffer for them, you would go up into heaven. So if you're a really, really, really good Catholic, you'd go immediately into heaven. But if you are not that great, you might spend a couple hundred years in purgatory, and then you'd make it into heaven. That's purgatory. This is different. To go into heaven today means I'm immediately in the presence of God. I'm immediately in bliss. However, what's happening in this chapter is heaven is coming down to earth. And I'll explain that in a little bit. So if you still got questions, save them for the end. Cool? All right, man. So anyway, we have to remember that John is writing this to a very specific group of people. And the group of people that he's writing to are undergoing some of the worst persecution that Christians have ever undergone. They're being killed. They're being executed. They're losing their jobs. They're losing their families. They're losing money. They're having their houses burned down. Crazy stuff is happening to the church right now. And so when John's writing about heaven, what he's doing is he's giving them hope. Hope is a very, very important thing in life in general. Hope is everything. If you take away someone's hope, they can't live. You could take away pretty much everything in my life, and as long as I have hope, I can make it. All right, let me give you guys an example. There were a lot of people in the Vietnam War, even in World War II, who were captured by the Japanese and the Vietnamese, and they were put through some of the worst tortures you could possibly imagine. They had bamboo shoots shoved up their fingernails. They were put in a chair and had their backs creaked back, and they had to have water drip on their heads until it bore a hole inside of their heads. Crazy stuff was done to these guys. Yet they were able to make it. And when they came back, they might have been a little bit jacked up, but they were actually relatively intact. The reason why they were able to undergo that level of suffering is because they had a hope. Their hope was, I know my family's waiting for me at home. I know I'm going to get out of here one day, and I know I'm going to make it back. Does that make sense to you guys? That hope enabled them to get through terrible things. If you don't have hope, though, everything else in your life could be going great, and you're still going to want to put a bullet in your head. And what hope is, by the way, hope is a desire or an expectation for something you don't have yet. If you don't have any hope, if you don't have any desire, if you don't believe, to put it another way, if you don't believe that things are going to get better in your life, you're going to want to commit suicide. Right? That's what depression is, by the way. It's living a life of hopelessness. It's thinking that things won't get better and imagining that, you know, it's just going to get worse. Right? So if you take away someone's hope, you take away their ability to live or function. Or let me just talk at your guys' level. School sucks, right? Right? You can tell me. I know. It sucks. All right. Everyone will tell you this is the best time of your life, and I look at those people and I'm like, you're liars, you know? You're just full of crap. I've been out of school for 8 years now, and I am so happy I am. I've never looked back and be like, oh, I miss high school, you know? Like, I've never thought that, not even once. School is terrible, all right? But you're able to undergo school because you have a hope, right? What's your hope?
To get out,
right? And so you're able to undergo this horrible amount of suffering because you know one day I'm going to get out. If someone told you, hey, you know what, Savannah, you're not going to get out. School's forever. you'd probably just kill yourself, right? You'd be like, yeah, I don't think I want to go on, you know? If there's no hope, there's no future, I'm done, right? And people have used that to their advantage sometimes, that they know that if you give people hope, they can undergo a lot of suffering without bringing up a lot of complaints. Another good example, how many of you guys have ridden a plane before? Now, whenever there's a delay on a plane, they'll say, don't worry, it's only going to be about 10 minutes. It will never be 10 minutes, right? You'll be on that plane for hours before they fix the problem. But they realize something. If I give people a 10-minute hope, they can make it, right? But if I don't give them a 10-minute hope, they're going to start rioting in the streets, right? So I got to say something, right? So I say, hey, 10 minutes. And then after 10 minutes, I say another 10 minutes, another 10 minutes until finally the problem gets fixed, right? So I'm giving people hope just so they can make it through their current situation. You guys understand that? Hope is very important. So what John is doing for us is he's giving us a hope. But here's the catch. In order for hope to be even remotely helpful, it has to have three things in it, okay? First of all, it has to be realistic. You have to believe that it can actually happen. Secondly, it has to be transcendent, meaning it has to go above and beyond your problems. Another way to put that is that hope can't be something that can be taken away. And I'll explain that in a second. And the final thing about hope is that it has to be desirable, meaning you actually have to want this to happen in order for it to help you. If it doesn't have those three things, hope will not help you at all. And this is why, by the way, the majority of Christians are not helped by the Christian hope of heaven. Most of us don't want heaven. Most of us would kind of just rather just not to go there. We're like, yeah, I'm going to go to heaven one day. But we don't really think about it. We don't really meditate on it. I mean, how many of you guys very honestly sit around at home and like, I can't wait to go. You know, like, this is going to be awesome. I'm going to go to heaven, man. This is great, you know. No, we don't think about it. We think about our lives right now. Okay. The reason why heaven is not that great of a hope for us is because it's not these three things in our minds. Okay, it's not these three things. Let's go over them real quickly. First of all, it has to be realistic. It has to be believable. I have to actually think that it's going to happen, right? For instance, for those of you guys who are in school, when I said that you hope to get out one day, that's a realistic hope, right? It's not a weird hope. It's not something that you have to like wonder about. And some of you guys fantasize about what it would be like to not have to do homework anymore, and it makes you really happy. You're like, man, I've gone to summer vacation before. I know what that's like. That would be great if I just never had homework again. And it helps you, right? Because it's realistic. It could actually happen. One of the reasons why the Christian hope does not appeal to us is because it sounds so otherworldly. It sounds so bizarre that we almost don't want it to happen. We're like, okay, so I'm going to go to a place in the clouds with a harp, and I'm going to be with God who looks like I don't know, and I'm going to be away from all my friends and my family and the things I love. And you see, the more you think about it, the more it kind of freaks you out. You're like, I actually don't kind of want to go there. Some people have even very depressingly have put it that heaven is like a church service that never ends, and that's hell, honestly. That would be terrible. That's not what heaven is, right? So because heaven is not realistic, we don't think about it very much. We're just like, okay, it's going to happen, but whatever. And we don't really think about it. It's not really a helpful hope in our lives. The second reason why it's not helpful is because it's not transcendent. Okay, transcendent means that the hope is stable. It means that it can't be taken away. The reason why this is one of the most important things about hope is because the most damaging thing that can happen to somebody is having their hope taken away. Right? If I want to make a little kid cry, all I got to do is give him candy and take it away, right? Now, 5 seconds before you give him the sucker, he's perfectly happy with his life. Right? He doesn't want a sucker. But if you give him a sucker and then you take it away from him, all of a sudden his life has ended, right? All reality has collapsed in on itself and he doesn't want to go on. Why? Because you've given him hope and then you've taken it away. That's also why the whole airplane thing really sucks, right? Because they give you a hope. They give you 10 minutes, you're going to be out of here. You wait 10 minutes, and then when 11 minutes goes by, you're like, I'm never getting out of here. And you start freaking out and panicking. The reason why is because you were given hope, and it was taken away. That's the most damaging thing that you could ever do to somebody. In the Marine Corps, they did this to us often, right? So in the Marine Corps, like when you get to boot camp, I don't know if you guys have ever seen movies of boot camp or whatever, but they just torture you, right? They just call you names, they tease you, they beat you up, they make you do the most degrading things you've ever done. You're not even a person. I don't know if you guys know this, but in boot camp, you can never refer to yourself as me or I. You have to say this recruit. You know why? Because recruit is less than human. That's what they tell you. No joke. They look at you and say, recruits are not human. You do not call yourself an I. You're not an I. You are an it. And they say, so you have to refer yourself as this recruit. You're not a person in boot camp. And you just get tortured for 3 months and you hate your life. But the hope they give you is they say, don't worry, man. Once you get to the third month of boot camp, things are way better. Then you get to the third month of boot camp, you know what you realize? Nothing's better. And then they're like, don't worry, man. When you become a Marine, everything's cool. Then you become a Marine and you still get tortured. They're still like, yeah, you're a Marine now, but you're still a, they call you boot, right? A boot is like a, it's a really derogatory term for someone who is just out of training, right? And they're just like, you're a stinking boot. No one cares about you. And they still torture you. They're like, hey, don't worry, man. Once you get to your unit, then everything's awesome. Then you get to your unit and you get tortured even more, right? So then these people are like, well, you know what? We're veterans, man. We've been overseas. We fought the fights. All right. So we could torture you guys. You guys suck. You're nothing but newbies. Then they're like, but don't worry. When you deploy, then when you come back, then you're treated with respect. You deploy, you come back, then you're still treated like crap. And you're just like, okay, this is, eventually you just lose hope. You're just like, okay, it's just never going to get better. I'm just okay with that, right? And that's why me and my friends, we used to have a saying. We said, abandon all hope. Right? It's from Dante's Inferno. If you abandon all hope when you go into the Marines, you'll be okay. But if you listen to people and you start hoping for things, then you're going to feel like crap, right? They used to do this to us, by the way, all the time on deployment. Like when we were deployed, they'd be like, hey, guys, don't worry. We're going home December 10th. You're going to be home by Christmas. Isn't that awesome? And we're like, yeah, that's really cool. And then like December 10th happens, they're like, oh, by the way, we're not going home for another month. And you're like, what? You told us December 10th. I already told my family. Like, what's going on? They're like, it sucks. You know, you shouldn't have told them that. This is a secret operation. You know, you shouldn't have said that anyway. You're just like, dude, you're such a jerk. So the more you get your hopes up, though, the more it's crushed. You guys understand that? In order for the heavenly hope to be an actual hope that's going to help us, it has to be something that is solid, that you actually believe is going to happen, that you believe is not going to be taken away from you. Now, this hope kind of fails on its transcendency because a lot of us believe that it will be taken away from us. Right? A lot of us in our lives, we doubt our salvation. We doubt whether or not God will actually let us in. And so because of that, we live on this precipice of fear, right? Where we're like, I don't know if God's actually going to let me in. So the hope doesn't actually help. It's not transcendent. The final thing that it has to be is it has to actually be desirable. Meaning, do you want it to actually be true? If heaven was a real place, do you actually want to go there? Is the way to put that. Now, once again, a lot of us would say no. Why? Because a lot of the images of heaven that we've received since we were kids, honestly sounds really lame. It sounds really terrible. I love the way that C.S. Lewis puts this. He helped me a lot. This is Mere Christianity in his chapter on hope. And he says this: there's no need to be worried about stupid people who try to make the Christian hope of heaven ridiculous by saying they don't want to spend eternity playing harps on a cloud. The answer to such people is that if you cannot understand books written for grown-ups, then you shouldn't talk about them either. All the scriptural imagery, harps, crowns, gold, etc., is of course a merely symbolical attempt to express the inexpressible. Musical instruments are mentioned because for many people, not all, music is the thing known in the present life which most strongly suggests ecstasy and infinity. Crowns are mentioned to suggest the fact that we are united with God in eternity to share His splendor, power, joy, and glory. Gold is mentioned to suggest the timelessness of heaven. Gold does not rust, and the preciousness of it is amazing. People who take these symbols literally might as well think that Christ told us to be like doves. When Christ told us to be like doves, He meant that we should actually lay eggs. Okay? So I really like the way that he put it. The reason why we're so freaked out about heaven is because we read Revelation 21. And we think that this is actually what it's going to be like. It's not. Everything that John is saying in Revelation 21, it's a symbol. Do you guys understand that? It's meant to point to something. That's not actually what heaven is going to be like. If I really believe that, then I would actually have to picture God as being a dude who just sits on a chair all day, right? He's sitting on his throne. I'm like, okay, I think that's what God's like. That's not what he's like. All these are symbols to help us understand something that's not understandable. It's beyond us. So he uses examples, he uses symbols, he uses metaphors to try to help us wrap our minds around these things. But if you take these things literally, no, heaven is not going to be desirable to you one iota. You're going to think of heaven, you're going to be like, that sounds really stupid. Okay? So let's go through these symbols one at a time, and we're going to talk about why it should be so desirable. And I hope as we go through this, what I'm hoping you guys see and what God has shown me in my life is that heaven is not only desirable, heaven is the answer to every single thing that you long for in your life. Heaven is the completion of everything that you want to be true, but it's not actually true. So heaven is everything that we do long for, everything that we do desire. Let's begin. Verse 1. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. Also, there was no more sea. Point 1 about heaven. Heaven is physical. Heaven is physical. It is not spiritual. One of the reasons why a lot of people freak out about heaven is because we're told that we're going to be giant spirits floating in the sky. That doesn't appeal to anybody because everything that we enjoy about reality is that we could touch it. We like eating things. We like smelling things. We like feeling things. The idea that you're going to be an intangible spirit for all of eternity is stupid. No one wants that. In fact, the Apostle Paul put it this way. This is 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and in verse 1. Paul talking about the Christian hope of what we call the resurrection. He says this. For we know that if our earthly house, this tent, which is your body, by the way, he's talking about your physical body, is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this we groan earnestly, desiring to be clothed with our habitation, which is from heaven. If indeed, having been clothed, we shall not be found naked. For we who are in this tent groan, being burdened, not because we want to be unclothed, but further clothed, that mortality may be swallowed up by life. Do you see what he's saying? When he's saying unclothed or naked, what he's saying is that the thought in Paul's day was that you are going to be a spirit for eternity. And Paul says no one actually wants that. No one wants to be naked. No one wants to just be a spirit floating around nowhere. We don't want to be done with our bodies. We just want better bodies, right? Isn't that the truth? I don't want to be out of my body. I just want a body that doesn't get sick every single time I eat gluten, you know, or a body that could run and not get tired or not have to sleep or not. Does that make sense? It's not that I don't like this body. I just don't like the limitations of this body. I don't like the fact that it's getting old. I don't like the fact that it's so stinging hard to lose weight. I don't like a lot of things about my body, right? But the thing that I like about my body is that it has the ability to interact with the physical universe. I like that. I don't want to lose that. In fact, whenever you see a movie or something like that about ghosts or spirits, they're always miserable, aren't they? Right? Like the evil ones are just pissed off that they have to be spirits, and so they just torture people. And then the good ones are just waiting for someone to set them free. No one wants to be an intangible spirit. That's lame. It's terrible, right? This is why the Christian hope is so necessary to understand. The Christian hope of heaven is that heaven is physical. He doesn't say, "And I saw heaven." He says, I saw a new heaven and a new earth. It means it's a restored planet. What God's going to do is he's not going to destroy the physical universe that we know. He is going to remake it. So everything that you like about this earth that's good is still going to be in heaven. But all the things that you don't like about this earth won't make it. They don't make the cut, if that makes sense to you guys. So 120 degree weather, that's not going to exist in heaven. Thank God. All right? So the things that you like, though, like waking up in the morning and seeing the rain and seeing a rainbow, that's still going to be there. There's still going to be water. There's still going to be springs. There's still going to be rivers and lakes. Ocean is debatable. I personally think there will be an ocean. But after verse 1, you notice at the end it says, also there was no more sea. And a lot of people who like surfing are like, what? What? How is this heaven? You know, like that can't, it can't possibly be what they mean, you know, and they freak out. What I think this is mentioning, if you look at the earth, if you look at the reason why there's oceans, is because God was worried about what humanity would do to itself if it was all united. I mean, look at just what has happened since we figured out air travel and water travel and everything like that. Look at how quickly we've hastened to the destruction of mankind because we're unified, right? The only thing that kept mankind relatively alive for all those millennia was because we couldn't get to one another, right? The first time that anyone made it to a new land, they just started killing everybody, right? Christopher Columbus in 1492 found America. He's like, man, what a great continent. And then they started killing all the Native Americans, right? The only thing that kept the Native Americans relatively intact was because the Europeans couldn't get to them for thousands of years. Do you guys understand that? So God created natural barriers called the ocean to try to keep mankind from eliminating itself. But those barriers are relatively destroyed now, and now we're going to kill ourselves. And that's what Revelation tells us. When he says no more sea, what I believe he's trying to get at is he's getting at the idea there's not going to be any more divide between humanity. We're all going to be together. There's probably going to be an ocean around us, right? I think that what it's probably going to look like is it's probably going to be like Pangaea. You guys heard about that in school, right? Where just all the continents were one continent and it was surrounded by water. I think that's what this means. By the way, I could be wrong. Maybe there is no ocean, and you guys are just going to have to get over it. But I assume, I mean, the ocean is so cool, I just couldn't imagine God just getting rid of it. You know, that would be really weird to me. So I need to understand that heaven is physical, that everything about it is beautiful, and it's not something way different, but it's a perfection of everything that I love and I know here today. Another important verse that we need to look at is, if you guys skip ahead just to verse 24, it says this, and the nations of those who are saved shall walk in its light, and the kings of the earth bring their glory and honor into it. Its gates shall not be shut at all by day, for there shall be no night there. That's pretty cool, right? There's no more nighttime. It's all daytime. That's cool. And they shall bring the glory and honor of the nations into it. Now, here's why this is important. A lot of people have taken this verse and they said, this can't be talking about heaven because it's mentioning kings and nations. But if you look at the context, it has to be talking about heaven. That's the only thing that's in view here. So what that means is that, guess what? Even governments are still going to be in place when we get to heaven. See, I don't hate government. I hate certain things about the government, but I don't hate it. You know, it's actually kind of nice that we have our own. I mean, how many of you guys have a culture, like you have an ancestry that you're proud of? You're like, man, I kind of like the stuff about my ancestors. I like that we have these different things about us, the type of music that we like and the type of the rituals that we have. I kind of like those things. Do you guys understand that? And I don't want to go to heaven and be rid of them. Well, this is what it's saying to you. All those things that you liked about your heritage and your culture and your identity are still going to be there. You guys understand that? They're still going to be there. You're still going to have your cultural identity. There's still going to be nations. There's still going to be heritage. There's still going to be cultures. But what's not going to be there is division. Cultures are great. The problem with culture, though, is that we use it as a reason to hate each other. Right? So for me, right, let me give you guys an example. Okay, my sister is obviously just like me. Duh. She's white and Korean. She married a Latino guy. Okay? Which, whatever. Way to go. She married a Latino guy. Now, here's the thing. For those of you guys who don't know, those of you guys who are white, those of you guys who are Latino, you guys will know this. White people tend to be very schedule-oriented, and Asians as well. We tend to be very schedule-oriented, meaning it's very important in our culture to be on time. Latino cultures are not that way. All right? You can take that as an insult or not, but they're just not that way. All right? They just show up whenever. If you say you're going to have a party at 1, expect to be waiting, right? If Latino's coming. And the reason why they do that is because for a Latino, it's far more important to just spend quality time with someone than to be on time. You guys understand that? So if I say, hey, I'm going to have a party from 1 to 10, and I invite the Hispanic side of my family, okay, first of all, they're probably not going to show up till 4. And secondly, they definitely ain't leaving by 10. All right, they'll probably be there by like 4 in the morning, right? They're going to stay for the entire time. And the reason why they do that is because it's for them, they're just like, man, it's far more important for us to just have quality time together. Who cares about a schedule? This is about enjoying each other and having fun. Do you guys understand that? See, but because my cultural identity is so good to me, I don't look at what they do and say, well, that's different. I look at what they do and say, that's wrong. That's sin. You know, like how would they show up late? You know, that how they stay late? That's ridiculous. That's so insensitive, right? So I don't look at it as different. I look at it as wrong. Do you guys understand that? And then they look at me and they say, man, Peter's really cold. Dude, all he cares about is if we get there on time. Man, he's trying to kick us out at 10. This is ridiculous, right? So both of us look at each other and we said, you're wrong. And I say, you're wrong, right? Or when you look at different cultural things that they like, right? Music, food, right? Clothing. See, if there's a culture that I like, that's great. But if there's a culture that has something that I don't like, I'm like, that's gross. Right? I can't believe they eat that. That's nasty. That's wrong. You know, that's like sinful. I think they're from the devil. You know, like I can't believe that is so disgusting. I can't believe they would even think to wear that, you know. See, we look at differences and we see them as wrong. See, nature, culture, nations, that kind of thing, those are good. But what's wrong with it is our selfishness. You notice what he says? The kings of the earth will bring their glory into New Jerusalem. Did you guys catch that? That means that the things that are different about those nations are seen as beautiful. Does that make sense? And they're able to bring something different into the kingdom of God that's appreciated. Isn't that cool? Right? So heaven, once again, is not a destruction of everything you love. It is a perfection of everything you love. Music, sports, movies, all those things, they're going to be in heaven, right? God created them. He likes them. They're good. Just the things that are wrong about them will be separated out. Let me give you guys another example. Adam and Eve, right? We have to remember what the Christian hope of heaven is. Other cultures, other religions, should I say, when they think about heaven, heaven is something that humanity has never had. Right? So other religions just believe that mankind is just the way it is. This is it. And then when you die, you go to a heaven that's way different. And that's kind of what they believe. Christianity isn't that way. Christianity says that we once were in heaven. That's what the Garden of Eden was. That was heaven. That was perfection. That was unity with God, unity with each other. That was everything that we could have ever wanted. And look at the way they lived. Adam and Eve ate things. Adam and Eve drank. Adam and Eve had relationships with one another. They were happy. Does that make sense? There was trees. There was forests. There was grass. There was animals. There was all these. Does that make sense? And what God is saying, he's saying, I'm not going to get rid of all those things. I'm just going to bring them back. I'm going to make them perfect. Right? There's going to be everything you love about this earth will be in heaven. It will just be better. That's what it is. Now, this is another cool example. Jesus. When Jesus rose from the dead, he did it for multiple reasons. One of the reasons why he did it was to show off the new body, was to show off humanity 2.0, what it's going to actually look like. And if you notice the things that Jesus was able to do, it's actually really cool. First of all, he was able to eat. He walked in and he asked for food, and he ate it. But he actually, it's kind of insinuated that he didn't need to eat. See, right now, we don't have a choice. We have to eat. If we don't eat, we die. So food is good, but at the same time, it's kind of hard to enjoy it because if you don't eat it, you're going to die. See, in heaven, the cool thing about it is that you won't need, there's no such thing as death. There's no such thing as hunger or sickness or pain. So eating is just for pleasure, which is really neat. And you can't get fat, which is another cool thing. All right. So Jesus was able to eat, first off. Secondly, Jesus was able to enter into a room without using a door, which means that he was able to just be anywhere he wanted. One of the things that I hate about this physical body is that it's limited. If I want to go to another place, I have to get in my car and I have to drive through Tucson traffic. God help me, right? And it's terrible and I don't like it. Okay? But if I could just be somewhere just by thinking about it, that would be pretty sweet. I mean, could you imagine just like, man, I kind of want to go to the beach today. And you just go to the beach and enjoy the beach. And you're like, you know what? I kind of want to visit, you know, my mom today. And you can just go to her house instantly, just be right there instead of having to travel. You guys understand? Do you see how much time that would free up for us and how much easier things would be if we would be able to do that? Right? Jesus was able to do that. So the physical body of Jesus demonstrates what kind of life we're going to have for eternity. Jesus wasn't resurrected in a physical body just because, hey, I have it for now, but I'm going to lose it. Whenever John sees Jesus in Revelation, he has the body. He recognizes him. He knows that it's Jesus. You guys understand that? Another important thing about the fact that Jesus has a body and he's a person, and Adam and Eve as well, is that heaven is personal. Meaning you maintain your identity in heaven. Another big fear that we have is like, you know, what am I going to be like in heaven? And we kind of fear that. We're like, you know, am I still going to be me? Because it says that you're going to be Christ-like, and you're like, okay, well I read about Jesus, and he kind of seems like a prude in some parts, you know, and I don't know if I want to be like that, you know. Does that guy even like having fun? You know, can I still have fun? Am I going to be able to make jokes? Is there going to be humor in heaven? Or is everything all stoic and serious, you know? Like, you crack a joke in heaven, they're just like, get out, you know? Like, just get out of here, and they throw you out. You know, there's no jokes, there's no humor, there's no fun, there's no sports. They're just like, dude, we're just about worshiping God here, man. All right? You take your fun attitude and you get out of here, all right? We read the Bible for all of eternity, and we sing hymns, and that's what this is, you know? Like, no, and you're like, dude, that sucks, you know? What's up? Yeah, the Amish church forever. And you're like, no, I don't want to be in Quaker society. And it, like, it freaks us out a little bit. That's not what heaven's going to be. When you see Adam and Eve, you see Jesus, they have personalities. They're people. They're individuals. And we see their individual nature because Adam is different than Eve and they relate to each other. Do you guys understand that? You have to have an individual identity in order for there to be a community. And that's what heaven is. It's a community, and we'll talk about that in a second. But that means that everything about your personality that's good is going to make it to heaven. But everything about your personality that's bad won't. Praise God. Because when all of us look at our personalities, if you're honest, there are a lot of things you don't like about your personality, and you wished it would change. You know why that's in you? And you know why it frustrates you so much that you can't change it? It's because you remember. In a way, in a weird way, we are all built with this knowledge of what we were supposed to be. And we're not that way, and so it frustrates us. Heaven is not a negation of your personality. It's a completion of your personality. You will still be an individual in heaven. And that's awesome, right? The Hindus don't think that way. When you die in Hinduism, you go into the force, basically. I call it the force. They call it something different. But you go into the force, and you cease to be an individual. And they put it this way, it's like when a single drop falls into the ocean, right? And it becomes a part of the great ocean, greater than itself. Now that sounds really cool and mystical, but if you really stopped and put some actual brain effort into that, you'd realize no one wants that. Everything that you like about this life has to do with your individuality and relating to other people, isn't it? Not only your own personal individuality, but the fact that other people are different than you. That you're able to relate to them and you're able to hang out with them. Some of the best times in my life have been in my relationships with people. Right? So the idea that I'm going to lose my identity in heaven, that's not a hope. That's a curse. I don't want that. But this is the beautiful thing. You will still be an individual in heaven. You will still be you when you get to heaven. Just everything about yourself that you look at and you realize is wrong will be gone. It'll be perfected. That's what we really want when we stop and think about it. Now, to talk about a little bit what Jordan said, I think this is awesome because J.R.R. Tolkien had an interesting thought about heaven, and I think that he's right. If you ever watch the Lord of the Rings movies, you notice that there's three races, right? There's elves, dwarves, and men. Elves are supposed to represent the heavenly part of man. Dwarves are supposed to represent the earthly part of man. Okay, if you guys didn't know that, that's why he did it. Oh yeah, and the hobbits are to represent like the childlike part of man. But anyway, so I'm going to focus on elves and dwarves because they're the cool ones. Let's face it, hobbits suck. All right, so elves and dwarves. Okay, yeah, they got big feet and they're hairy and no one likes them. All right. Anyway, when you got elves, where do they live? They live in the forest and the Rivendell, like right in the waterfall, and they live in nature, right? They don't really mess with nature too much, if you notice. Whenever they go inside of one of their places, all they've done is they've reconstructed nature so they could live in it. They haven't really altered it too much. You guys see that? Then you got the dwarves, and the dwarves of the mines, right? Now what the dwarves do, they're totally opposite from the elves. The elves take something that's already beautiful, and they just live in it. The dwarves take something super ugly, and they make it cool, right? So you go in the dwarvish mines, and they got these tunnels, and they got these chandeliers, and they got the gold, and they got everything. And they're making something that was once lame, and they're making it really cool through their ingenuity. You guys understand that? And what J.R.R. Tolkien is saying is he's saying that what heaven is elves meeting dwarves. Meaning heaven is a perfection of this. Heaven is a perfection of God's beauty that we want to live in, and man's ingenuity that makes the beauty even better. See that? So that means that technology and stuff is not the devil, as much as I say it is. It's not. You know, it was made from man's ingenuity. It's a good thing. So the things that man is able to innovate and invent and create, the reason why we're able to do those things is because we're made in the image and likeness of God. God's a creator, right? We're a sub-creator. We're creative like God, but we're limited. We can't create like God. So in heaven, our creative abilities are going to be just brought to a new level. We're going to be able to do things that we weren't able to do here. So the things that you guys like to do as an individual will still be intact in heaven. If you like art, you're just going to be a perfected artist. Okay? Not that art. You're going to be perfect. If you like music, you're going to be a perfected musician. Everything you like to do, music, is just going to be taken to a whole new level that you can never even dream to have this side of heaven. Right? If you like video games, if you like whatever you like, it's just going to be perfected. If you like sports, if you like athleticism, you're going to be in a body that's perfect. Right? Everything's going to be perfected because of your individualism, because of your likes, because of what is perfected for you and in you. Okay? That's the beauty of heaven. Now let's keep going though. Verse 2-4. Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of the heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. So there's two symbols here that I want you guys to get. Number one, he looks up and he sees heaven like a city, right? Which is weird to us. He doesn't say, and I looked up and I saw the New Jerusalem, which is the holy suburb or the holy forest or the holy ocean or the holy... He could have said a lot of things, but he describes it like a city. Beyond being a city, this is actually like a hardcore city. If we go a little further, he says this city is like a cube. And it is 1,380 miles in length, width, and height. So it's a cube, 1,380 miles long, 1,380 miles wide, and 1,380 miles tall. So when you think about what kind of cities need to build up, right? You think of New York, you think of Manhattan, you think of the idea that you have this tiny little space, right? Manhattan's like this tiny little island, yet it has like 9 million people living on it somehow. And the reason why they're able to do that is because they realize there's not enough space around, so they build up. So when you're in a city like that, you got people around you, and you got people above you, you got people below you. It's a city designed for maximum saturation of people. You guys see that? It's a city designed for maximum saturation of people. And that's what heaven looks like. Now, what is he trying to get across by saying that heaven is like this metropolis, like this giant city? Why is he trying to say that? Here's why. One of the purposes of heaven is relationships. Heaven is relational. Heaven is a perfected community. That's what it is. We were designed by God to be community-driven beings. We like being with people. We like hanging out with them. But the great dichotomy of man is that we love being with people, but we hate people, which is weird. we all want friends, but we hate people. And I don't know how that works out, but we just do. Jean-Paul Sartre, famous French philosopher, he said, hell is other people. And we all kind of understand that. We're like, yeah, I see that. But here's the deal. Heaven is other people, too. So what's wrong? Why do we love people, but we hate people? What's going on inside of us? Here's what's going on inside of us. There are a couple reasons why we can't stand people. Number one is the imperfections in them, and number two is the imperfections in you. Okay, let's start with the imperfections in them. Heaven is beautiful. A city would be beautiful if this city, if these people, if everyone around you was perfect. The reason why cities terrify us is because people are imperfect. Right? If you ever want to know what kind of places have the highest rates of crime, it's where? Cities, right? Cities. You don't see that in the backwoods, right? There is crime, but it's not as much, right? The more populated an area gets, the more dense an area gets, the more crime comes. The reason why that happens, the reason why it's there, is because the imperfections in other people. There's angers, there's jealousy, there's fear, there's bitterness, there's resentment, there's racism, there's sexism, there's all sorts of things that are just wrong with other people. But one of the best things that could happen to us is being in a community of people that you absolutely love. I mean, it's kind of cool sometimes, right? When you're surrounded by a huge group of people that you absolutely love. Now, if you're surrounded by a huge group of people that you kind of hate, that's miserable. That's hell, right? I don't know if any of you guys have like gone to a party with someone and you don't know anyone there and it's just super awkward and you like kind of sit by yourself and you hate your life and you just want to go. That's terrible, right? But if you're at a place where you know everybody, you're friends with everybody there, you get along with everybody there, you love everybody there, and they all love you, that is awesome, right? That's amazing. That's fantastic. That's something that we all love to do. So one of the reasons why a lot of people would terrify us is because of the imperfections of them. It's not because people are the problem. It's because of the kind of people that's the problem. You guys understand that? People in general isn't the problem. It's the type of people that becomes the problem. Heaven is a place where only pure people are. Only perfected people exist in heaven. That means there is no more jealousy. There's no more cliques in heaven. There's no more anger in heaven. There's no more drama in heaven. There's no more she likes him, but I like her. And there's none of that, all right? It's just not there. Jesus says there's not going to be any romantic tension in heaven. It's just gone. There's only going to be pure, perfected relationships as far as the eye can see. Every single person that you meet in heaven, you will instantly love and have a genuine relationship with them. You're going to have perfect fellowship and relations with other people all the time. There's no more misunderstanding. And here's a cool thing. There's no time and there's no goodbyes. One of the things that we hate doing more than anything, have you ever just hung out with someone and you've spent like hours and hours with them and you just never want it to end, but you know it has to? Heaven is cool because there's no time. Right? We exist on time right now. I got schedules. I got things to do. There's sun up. There's sun down. In heaven, there's no night. There's no time. Right? We can't even conceive of that. That means that I have literally an eternity to spend with each individual person. I have no limit. That's a lot of coffee, man. I could spend an eternity with anyone I want. There's no time. There's no limits. There's no having to say goodbye. There's no parting. There's no death. Right? You never have to say goodbye in heaven. Isn't that cool? Now, the second reason why we kind of fear heaven is because you suck, right? It's not just because people suck. You suck. You know it. So one of the reasons why we're afraid to be around other people is because we fear rejection, right? We fear rejection. We're afraid of what other people think about us because we know we're imperfect and we know we have problems and we don't want other people to see it. It terrifies us. It scares us that other people are going to be able to see us, and that is what is really scary to us. And that is what brings in the second image. If you notice, it's really weird. The city is the bride. Did you guys catch that? Verse 3, the city's coming down and he says it's dressed like a wife. And you're like, the city's like a wife? That's weird. It's like a city wearing a dress. It's really odd. What this is signifying is it's signifying the beauty that God is going to put in you. Let's go to verse 9. Okay. Verse 9 says this. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls filled with the seven last plagues came to me and talked with me, saying, come, I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain, and he showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God, having the glory of God. Her light was like the most precious stone, like jasper stone, clear as crystal. Also, she had a great and high wall with 12 gates and 12 angels at the gates. The names written on them were the 12 tribes of Israel. 3 gates on the east, 3 gates on the north, 3 gates on the south, 3 gates on the west. Now, the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. He who talked with me had a gold reed to measure the city, its gates, its walls. And the city was laid out as a square. Its length is as great as its breadth. He measured the city with the reed, 12,000 furlongs, or 1,380 miles. Its length, breadth, and height are equal. Then he measured its wall, 144 cubits, according to the measure of a man. this and of an angel. The construction of its wall was of jasper, and the city was like pure gold, like clear glass. The foundations of the wall of the city were adorned with all kinds of precious stones. The first foundation was jasper, sapphire, chalcedony, emerald, sardonyx, sardius, chrysolith. I don't even know if I'm saying these right anymore. All right, let's go to verse 21. The 12 gates were 12 pearls. Each individual gate was one pearl, and the street of the city was pure gold, like transparent glass. Now, why do I say that that refers to our own purity? Well, remember what I said. The city looks like a what? What is it? It's like a bride, right? It's like a wife. Who is the bride of Christ? The church. People. Individuals. We are the bride of Christ. So that means that what John is seeing in the city, when he's giving us these images, he doesn't actually mean that we're going to be going into every, like C.S. Lewis said, he doesn't actually mean we're going to go into the city and everything's made out of gold and it's blinding you and you're like, oh my gosh, this kind of sucks. I don't know why, who thought of this? You know, what building manager thought that this would be a good idea? That's not what he's talking about. He's saying it's a symbol. It's a symbol for what? For what you and I are going to be like. Everything about this city is beautiful. Everything that he mentions in this city, the gold, the precious stones, and the pearls are all elements on this earth that we would look at and we would say they are pure, without fault. He's saying the gold is so pure that you could see through it. Saying the precious gems, the reason why precious gems are so precious is because they're pure. There's no other mineral in them. They're absolutely pure. That's why they're beautiful. That's why diamonds and sapphires and rubies and all these things are so precious and valuable is because they're perfect. They're whole. There's nothing wrong with them. Pearls as well. They're just precious, beautiful treasures. What God is saying to us when he's describing the cities, he's saying, you will be the treasure of God. God will make you like this city. He will make you pure, beautiful, without spot. You know, I like watching fairy tale movies, as you guys probably know. One of the best things about fairy tale movies that gets to our hearts is because what we see in fairy tale movies is we see two things, and both are things that we desperately want. Number one, we see a prince love a princess in spite of her flaws. Right? In every fairy tale movie, the princess, let's be real, she's got some issues, right? She's got some baggage. Okay, you go into Cinderella, you got Cinderella, I mean, come on, do you really think that having your dad die and then being a slave for 10 years, do you really think that's not going to get to you? You're not going to have some emotional problems at some point if that's what really happened to you? You got Rapunzel, grew up her whole life alone in a tower. Come on, you're definitely going to be socially awkward at some point if that was your life, right? They got a bunch of baggage, there's something wrong with them. But the beautiful thing about the story is that you got this prince where there's nothing wrong with him. He's rich, he's attractive, everyone loves him. And he sees this princess, and he loves her for who she is. You guys get that? And when we watch those movies, it arouses something in us because that's the kind of love we want. We want someone to love us just as we are. We want someone to accept us just as we are. But here's the catch. In my life, I have had people accept me just as I am. But you know what kind of people accept me just as I am? People who are just as messed up as I am. Does that make sense? So when I'm hanging out with my buddies at school and we're all viewing porn and we're all doing wrong things, we're like, man, we all kind of suck and we all kind of like each other in our suckiness. The reason why fairy tales are so cool is it's not just that we want someone to love us as we are. We want someone perfect to love us as we are. Do you guys get that? It's not enough for someone who is just as bad as you are to love you. You want someone who is legitimately perfect to love you as you are. And that doesn't exist. Not on this earth. The only people who actually love you for who you are the people who are just as messed up as you. The people who are better than you, the people who you wish you could be like, they don't actually look at you that way. The gospel is beautiful because it describes a king who traveled from his perfect country, went down to your ghetto, found you, loved you just as you were, and actually was willing to die for you in your garbage. Right? Do you notice that it says that Jerusalem, he says, I saw Jerusalem coming down. Did you guys get that? That it's not earth reaching heaven, that's not the gospel, but it's heaven reaching earth. That's the first thing about love that we all want. But the second thing about love that we want is we realize if someone perfect loved me, I would be forever miserable. Because if someone was legitimately perfect and they were hanging out with you, you'd feel like crap all the time. Whenever you got into a fight with that person, you'd be like, yeah, it's me. You know, like, there's no other option. There's no way it's them. You know, it's definitely you. You'd always feel like junk. You'd always feel like garbage. It's not enough for someone to love you as you are because you don't even love you as you are. Every single one of us, if we looked in the mirror, if we really studied ourselves, we would find imperfections in our physical selves. Every single one of us, if we really examined our personality, we would find things about our personality that we do not like and we wish it wasn't there. If we looked at what kind of people we are, we would be unhappy with the kind of people we are. If we looked at our morality, we'd be unhappy with our own morality. There is every aspect of who you are you could look at and you could go like, man, I don't like that, I don't like that, I don't like that, I don't like that. And it depresses you. That's why the second part of love in fairy tales is so perfect. That the prince doesn't leave the princess where she is, but his love is so powerful it makes her just like he is. Right? It would be a really lame fairy tale if in the end of Cinderella, the prince is like, I love you so much, I'm going to move in with you. And I'm going to be a fellow slave to your stepmother. The end. You know, and that would be the end. They're both servants for the evil stepmother, and that's the end of the movie. Or in Rapunzel, if he's like, man, I really dig your tower. You know, we could go live in the castle, but this tower is pretty sweet too. You know, let's just live here forever. And that was the end. We would all walk out of the movie like, that was really stupid. I mean, I know that they love each other, and that's great, but they're in a crappy situation still. You know, that's not very good. The beauty of a fairy tale is that the love brings the princess out of her current state. That is what Christianity states. That Jesus' love for us is so pure, so powerful, so amazing that he loves you right where you're at, but his love purifies you too. His love makes you as you want to be. We all want to be better, but we're not. His love does that for us. His love brings us to the place where we are who we want to be. And it's not what we fear. It's not that God is looking at us saying, you need to be better for me. God is saying, I will make you better for you. Right? He fixes us for his own sake, for his own namesake, for your sake. And that's the beautiful thing about the gospel that we need to understand. The reason why it's described as a bride is because God is making us new. Let's go to verse 5 and 6 really quickly. Then he who sat on the throne said, behold, I make all things new. And he said to me, write, for these words are faithful and true. In the Greek, when he says, I make all things new, that verb tense is what we call the present progressive tense. Meaning this, it doesn't say, I will make all things new. I'm going to one day make all things new. That's not what it says. That would be enough, but that's not what it says. It says, I am making all things new. You know what that means? The process in which God will make you his beautiful bride has begun today. It's already started. It's not something that you got to sit down at your house and be like, well, I guess I got a lot to look forward to in heaven. No, you already have the down payment of heaven in you. The Holy Spirit's in you, and he is making you pure just as God is pure. He's making you holy just as God is holy. And what we're doing in this life is we're allowing God to do that work inside of us, and we're trusting him with it. Right? That's why he's saying these words are faithful and true. Do you believe that Jesus is going to make you like this? That one day you will look at who you are as a person and you will be absolutely satisfied with what you see. You will say perfect. Just as right now when he looks at you, he says perfect. And if you believe that, if you believe that that kind of affirmation exists for your heart, you will be able to function. You'll be able to keep moving and getting closer to Jesus and understanding, I am already beautiful, but one day I will be perfectly beautiful in him. Right? If you don't believe that, if you think it's going to happen one day, you're just going to be miserable right now. Every single time you think about yourself, you'll be like, man, I suck. But one day, right? One day I won't suck so hard, you know? And that's how you're going to live your life, and it's going to be miserable. But if you understand that it's already but not yet, that God has already put that beauty in you, and all he's doing is he's working it out. Right? Philippians 2, verse 12 is another verse that helps me. It says this, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who does in you both to will and to do. Now, that verse, at first glance, makes it sound like the opposite of what I've been saying all the time, right? That you need to work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. What really helped me to understand this verse is that word work out, right? I tend to think of it like working out, right? You got to exercise. You got to work it out, man. You got to build it. That's not what that word means. That word working out is actually, it's a mining term. It's a word that miners would use when they're mining for precious stones or metals. That means that the salvation is already in you. You're working it out. Does that make sense? The miners don't create gold. They don't go into the mountain and they form gold. They don't do that. They find it. They find something that's already there. What we're doing as Christians, we're not creating beauty. We're finding it. We're finding the beauty that God has already placed inside of us. For it is God who does in us both to will and to do. Great passages. Always need to keep it in my mind at all times. The final thing I'll say is about the relationships. Heaven is not only about a relationship with people, which would be enough. Heaven is about a relationship with God. It's about a fulfilled relationship with God. You and I were created for a relationship with God. So the more I love God, the more excited for heaven I'm going to get. That I want to be in His presence. That I want to be closer to Him. And that's what verse 22 through 23 is about. I saw no temple in it, for the Lord God Almighty is the Lamb, and the Lamb are the temple. The city had no need of the sun or the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God illuminated it. The Lamb is its light. Right? The reason for the temple back in the Old Covenant was a place where the Jews could come to draw near to God. That was His house, basically. What He's saying is that there's no need for that anymore. He says the Lamb and God are the temple. God's with us. He's dwelling with us. He's fixing everything. He's right there. You have an eternity with God. You will be able to relate to Him personally forever. No more separation. No more distance between you and God. It's eternal. Now, one last quick thing about the gold, the precious stones, and the pearls. When you notice that those are what is mentioned inside the city, the reason why those are also important to understand is gold, precious stones, and pearls are created through pressure, time, and heat. Right? The reason why gold is purified is because you got to melt it and you got to scoop out the impurities and you got to make it pure. Right? Precious stones, it takes a while for the cavern and the heat and all that stuff. I don't know if you guys ever studied geology, but precious stones are created through a lot of compression and pressure and time. Pearls are created because a little grain of sand got stuck in the throat of a clam and he coats it with a precious material that makes a pearl, right? So all those things, the reason why heaven has these images is because it's images of you. The beauty that God is bringing out in you will take time. But when the process is over, you will look at yourself and you will be pure. You will be perfect. And that's what we have to remember. It takes time, it takes pressure, it takes heat, right? It's not easy, but it's good. Right? It makes us exactly as we want to be. Now, final thing I'm going to say. Who is heaven for? Who is heaven for? Verse 6. And He said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain of the water of life freely to him who thirsts. He who overcomes shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, the abominable, the murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars shall be put have their part in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death." Who makes it to heaven? The thirsty. The thirsty. Anyone who thirsts, come and drink. That's what it says. Meaning the people who are going to make it to heaven are the people who thirst for heaven, who want heaven, who want God. He doesn't say anyone who is really brave, come to me and drink. Anyone who's really strong, come to me and drink. Anyone who's really smart, come to me and drink. Anyone who thirsts. That's what it takes to get to heaven. It's a thirst. It's a hunger for God. Let me read you guys this one last quote from Mere Christianity about hope. And then we'll be done. Thank God, right? It says this. He's talking about the hopes of this world and how they disappoint us. And he says this, "If I find in myself a desire which no experience on this earth can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was not made for this world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfy this longing, that does not prove that the universe is a fraud. Probably, earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy this longing, but only arouse it, to suggest the real thing. If that is so, I must take care, on one hand, never to despise or be unthankful for earthly blessings. On the other hand, I should never mistake them for something else. They are only a kind of copy or echo or mirage. They are not the beauty intended. I must keep alive in myself the desire for my true country, which I shall not find until after I die. I must never let it get snowed under or turned aside. I must make it the main object of life, to press on to that other country and to help others do the same. Christian hope is important, but we need to keep it alive in ourselves. It's easy to let go, to forget. We need to constantly remind us that everything in our life that lets us down, every disappointment, it's a thirst. It's that thirst that God's reminding us that you weren't made for this earth. You were made for something better. You weren't made for the failed relationships of this earth. You were made for perfected relationships. You weren't made for this failing body of yours. You were made for a better body. You weren't made for the destruction of this world. You were made for perfection. Heaven is not a consolation prize. It's not like God saying, hey, I know your life is tough here. I'm going to give you heaven later. Heaven is a consummation, or to put it another way, it's a perfection of every longing, every desire, everything that you thirst for on this earth. That's what heaven is. And the more we remember that, the more we pray about it, the more we seek it, the more that hope is going to be able to get you through whatever you're going through in this life. Right? Let's pray. Dear God, I want to thank you for your word, for your hope of heaven that is so beautiful to us. God, that you are making all things new. Help us to remember that. Help us to hold on to that. Help us to trust in that. We are so grateful for all the things that you are doing in us. Please continue them. And in your name, amen.